I wasn't quite ready, sorry, oops. But that is the point where, as I said, Young People Sunday Club is back on, so you guys want to make your way out. Youth group as well, if you want to get out of that way, have a great time. Yeah, it's okay, you can go. Yeah, Debbie's all ready. Francesca set it all up. It's wonderful each week to just see momentum just slowly, slightly building, more people coming. It's wonderful. So, bye guys. And then hopefully, is there a PowerPoint? Have we managed? We have got this one, have we, Harrison? Yeah, good. He's nodding. He's nodding, which always reassures me. So that passage from Isaiah, we're going to be thinking through. Now, there was an English lesson, and the English teacher was trying to teach all the boys in his class about what different words mean. And he asked them if anybody knew what the difference between ignorance and apathy was. At which point, little Johnny just shrugged his shoulders and said, "Don't know, don't care." Now, if last week was all about what God's people should be like after they return from the exile, this week is more back down to earth of what people were really like. It's great having Ken Watts here this morning. I've obviously known Ken the whole time I've been here, and over the 8 years or so, we've had many conversations where we put the world to rights, and there's a common theme every time we talk about it. That's right, Ken, isn't it? That Ken will always say that actually, opposition isn't the problem. He is quite open about his faith, and over the 80 plus years, he really has experienced very little people, you know, persecuting him, shouting him down. What's the biggest problem that you tend to have, Ken? Absolutely. Totally agree with Ken. The biggest problem in the church in the UK today is indifference, is apathy. Don't know, don't care. And if so, Isaiah diagnoses that problem right here in this passage this morning, and he gives us the antidote too in the end of chapter 56, the first half of chapter 57. He gives us two factors that cause spiritual apathy in the first place. They're not the only factors, but they're two common factors that cause spiritual apathy. And then in the second half of chapter 57, he goes on to shake us out of that apathy. He gives us the antidote. So what we're going to do, first of all, in part one, as it were, we're going to begin with the two problems. As I say, they're not the only causes of apathy, but they were certainly the two main ones in Isaiah's day, and they resonate today too. Number one, narcissistic leaders. And number two, two-timing hearts. So, let's begin with the narcissistic leaders. If you could move on to the next slide, Harrison, please. See, a narcissist is someone who is in love with themselves. Give just at random one example. The people we see here in Isaiah's day are apathetic and ignorant because their leaders are ignorant and self-serving. Verse 10, they have just one job to do and they can't even do that. Israel's watchmen are blind. They all lack knowledge. They are mute dogs. They cannot bark. They lie around and dream. They love to sleep. You know, Isaiah's basically saying to the leaders of Israel, you had one job to do and you didn't do that. A bit like a lookout who's blind. Now, of course, blind people can do all sorts of things, but the one thing a blind person can't do, the one role they can't perform, is to be a watchman, a lookout. It's like a guard dog who doesn't bark when people are trying to break into the house. See, one of the main jobs of shepherds of God's people is to be a watchdog, to bark loudly when dangerous people are coming around. False teachers, false shepherds. Isaiah is saying that Israel had gone astray because their leaders, their watchmen, their shepherds had failed to do the job they were supposed to do. Instead of praying for the people, they were praying on the people. They were too selfish to be watchdogs. Instead of barking at the unwelcome faces, they were only interested in filling their faces. Isaiah says, they are dogs with mighty appetites. They never have enough. They are shepherds who lack understanding. They all turn to their own way. They seek their own gain. Now that is a very common image in the Bible, most famously in Ezekiel chapter 34, picked up by Jesus when he says he's the good shepherd in John 10. These are shepherds who want to fleece the flock rather than feeding the flock. Their motto is simple: make me great again. And then as I was studying the passage and I got to verse 12, I thought, well, how prophetic for today's church. Come, each one cries, let me get wine, let us drink our fill of beer, and tomorrow will be like today or even better. Now, Isaiah is not giving a teetotal campaign. He's not denouncing all drinking of alcohol, nor is he against optimism. But the key thing to notice is, what is the optimism of these leaders based on? Absolutely nothing. You know, yeah, it's all going to be great, people, they say. But it's just the booze talking. There's nothing more here than Dutch courage. A few weeks ago, I was watching a documentary on the BBC about online influencers who promote a particular kind of online trading with a website. It was basically sort of an expose of a form of pyramid selling. So these influencers on social media, they promote what a fantastic lifestyle they have, you know, all the fantastic cars they drive and all the clothes they wear. And they say, in effect, I've earned all this money by this online trading with this website, so if you join, then you'll be rich too. Of course, what the program showed was the influencers don't, very few people actually earn a lot of money through that trading, unless you really know what you're doing. The influencers are only getting wealthy because they get a cut from all the people who sign up to the website. But anyway, as I was watching it, I had one of those moments of late at night watching a documentary. I just thought, well, wait a minute, isn't that exactly how church operates today in the UK? You know, it's a leader or a church or a Christian organisation. And what we do most of the time, let's be honest, is just we put out this really glossy image, this sort of, you know, amazing lifestyle, and we say, follow Jesus because your life will be like that. And by the way, give us lots of money because so we can present this glossy lifestyle. Likewise, people make amazing claims about what God is going to do through our church or our denomination or following this great leader. Now, don't misunderstand me. Of course I long for revival. If you're a follower of Jesus, you long for God to pour out his spirit and for thousands of people to come back to Christ again. I long for that. But my question this morning, and Isaiah provokes this question, is what is this kind of optimism based on? Is it actually based on anything? Who is testing the prophetic words? Where are the biblical grounds to believe that revival is just around the corner for our nation? I don't know about you, but often I hear the rallying calls of church leaders, and sadly, it does sound a lot like a drunk football fan. You know, it's going to be great. Shh. Okay, sarah, sarah. It's going to be amazing. Tomorrow is going to be great. It's going to be as good as today. Even better. Passages like this scare me witless as a church leader. Because what it challenges me is that I face a constant temptation to make church about me. About my needs. To stop being a watchdog and to become a mutton butcher instead. So the first application of this passage is, you guys need to watch me. And then it's also so appropriate, isn't it? Alan will have to watch this later online. But what a passage to have when you start as associate pastor. If you're listening later, I hope the hairs are standing up on the back of your neck, Alan, as you read this. Because you'll be really careful about your task, what you're really called to do, a watchman, but also the temptations that come with it. So, you guys as well, watch Alan as he starts. Watch me, watch the deacons, watch Karen. Church leadership is about serving others, not about serving yourself. Don't let us turn this church from a sheep pen into an abattoir. Because when that happens, we suffer, you suffer, everybody suffers. Now, let's think about this. It doesn't just mean that it's your job as church members to hold the leaders accountable. You know, that isn't just the kind of who watches the watchman. It also means that your job is to support us when we bark. If one of my main jobs is to be a watchman, to be this guard dog, then please don't get offended when I compare other church leaders to drunk football fans. Because that's my job, isn't it? But the bigger question here, which the church, particularly in the West, has got to wrestle is, why do we keep doing this? Why do we keep appointing narcissistic leaders? Men who are just so in love with themselves. Well, the answer is pretty obvious, isn't it? It's because in church, we want the people at the front to be like looking in a mirror, don't we? See, if we appoint leaders who say, it's all about me, then that justifies me in my life saying, well, it's all about me too. Surprise. And so to misquote Carly Simon in her song, you're so vain, you probably think this psalm is about you. It's the first problem. It's what leads to apathy and turning away from the Lord is spoiled leadership, narcissistic leaders. But that then moves us on to the second half, the first half rather, of chapter 57. That kind of leadership then produces two timing hearts. If myself and Alan were feeling the heat earlier on, and now it's your turn to be in the spotlight. When we only care about ourselves, what happens is we don't really care about other people. Isaiah says, the righteous perish, and no one takes it to heart. The devout are taken away, and no one understands that the righteous are taken away to be spared from evil. Those who walk uprightly enter into peace. They find rest as they die in death. Now, there is some comfort there, isn't there? See, when, I don't know about you, but maybe we frequently talk about when we lose loved ones, when loved ones die in the Lord, sometimes we say they've been snatched cruelly away from us, don't we? Interesting, Isaiah doesn't use that kind of terminology. Literally, he says the righteous are gathered away to be spared from evil. Gathered away, the same word we saw at the beginning of chapter 56. The Lord gathers in this unusual way. Well, he gathers some away to spare them from evil. We trust in a God who's not surprised by evil. And he is always, as we saw last week, he's always out there gathering his people to himself. And so that means that when loved ones die in the Lord, our loss is their gain. And that they are actually being spared from something. And if we love them, then of course we want them to be spared from this evil and find rest. But Isaiah says that the self-obsessed don't notice that. A narcissistic culture becomes an apathetic culture because we're not really committed to anything. The way Isaiah describes it, very colourful language, isn't it? In verses 3 to 10, Isaiah calls them a family of adulterers and prostitutes. Now, he doesn't mean that literally. What he's saying is a spiritual metaphor, isn't he? He's saying that that the people of God are pathologically incapable of remaining faithful to the Lord. He's saying that it's like a husband who just keeps on having affair after affair after affair. Isaiah's saying that the people of God, they're just like that. Now notice, it's not that they've stopped following the Lord. They just keep being unfaithful to him. Just like today, isn't it? I won't be the 2021... at some point this year, the census will be coming out. And we'll find out how many people in this country identify as Christians. And I don't know, I'm guessing, let's say, I reckon it's going to be about 55%, so still a majority. But we all know that's not really true, as in not all of those people really follow the Lord. Well, it was the same in Isaiah's day. It wasn't that they stopped going to church. It wasn't that they converted to atheism or Islam or something. It wasn't like they divorced God and then married another God. No, they just wouldn't commit to anything. So they turned up at church, but then they did what they wanted during the week, and it all just flowed, didn't it? Sociologists tell us that we are the Starbo generation, S-T-A-B-O, subject to a better offer. That's what the people were like then. Our eyes, Isaiah says, are always lusting after better experiences, driven by another acronym, FOMO, our fear of missing out. You know, does this resonate? You love Jesus. I'm sure you do love Jesus. I love Jesus. But there's always this slight suspicion that there might be something else better out there. I don't want to be too, you know, I want to hedge my bets, don't I? Maybe I've been had. So, as Isaiah puts it, we flirt with the horoscope behind our doors. It's only a bit of fun. It's not like we kissed or anything. Okay, maybe I did flirt a bit with my old Hindu traditions. But it was just a one-night stand. It didn't mean anything. Isaiah says it did. When you do those things, you forsake the Lord, because he wants your heart committed to him alone. Now, what is so scary about this behavior is that it's something Isaiah says that we just drift into. Yes, I have met some people who have very dramatic sort of deconversion stories. You know, they were a Christian and just suddenly they're not. But that's quite rare. Marriages often end when couples just imperceptibly drift apart. Well, so it is with our commitment to the Lord. Verse 11. Whom have you so dreaded and feared that you've not been true to me and have neither remembered me nor taken this to heart? Now, the question expects a negative reply. In other words, it wasn't as if you were sort of happily following the Lord and then suddenly, I don't know, suddenly Zeus appeared, you know, amazing Zeus with his lightning bolts and his bulging muscles, and you were like, oh, Zeus, you're so amazing, I'm going to follow you now instead of God. Isaiah's saying it wasn't like that. You just drifted apart. And maybe that's been your experience under lockdown. Is it not because I have long been silent that you do not fear me? That we've just stopped listening to God. They had done that. They'd stopped. They just drifted. They just got out of the habit of reading the Torah, listening to the prophets. Now, how scary is that? Think about that for a moment. How scary, I hope it's scary to you, the idea that God can become silent. But notice, he doesn't become silent here because he stops talking. He becomes silent because we stop listening. Now, any married couple will know that dynamic. Research has shown that women speak twice as many words in their marriage as their husbands. Oh, to be fair, that's because they have to say everything twice. Now, that's not funny, though, when we talk about God, is it? Are you in that stage where you're just drifting away from him? Don't read your Bible anymore. Spiritual date night, it just kind of fizzled out. Because it's a catch-22, isn't it? Same with relationships. If habits like going out once a week or you know, an annual holiday, all those kind of things, if they are pointless, if there's no relationship in the first place, that's true. It's also true that relationships only grow and stay together because of those kind of rituals. So, you know, the ritual doesn't make the relationship, but you have to keep doing those things and keep investing in the relationship for it to flourish, don't you? Verse 12, I will expose your righteousness and your works, and they will not benefit you. Keeping the Sabbath, going to church, reading the Bible, they won't benefit you if they're just rituals, if they're just things you do. And there's actually, if you're honest, the real relationship with the Lord went years ago. It just kind of faded away. Isaiah would put it, you need to fear the Lord. When you cry out for help, let your collection of idols or your self-help books save you. The wind will carry all of them off, a mere breath will blow them away. Now, what Isaiah says, instead of this sort of two-timing heart that just won't really commit to anything, instead, we need to put our refuge, our trust of our hearts in the Lord. There's loyalty here. The one who trusts in the Lord is not two-timing, because they're loyal to the Lord. They've made that covenant promise to follow the Lord. Now, the band are going to get ready, because they're going to lead us in a song in a moment to respond. And I know a lot of modern songs can be a little bit kind of Jesus is my boyfriend-ish. But at the same time, we do need songs that encourage us to commit our love, our covenant love to the Lord, a bit like husband and wife make their vows. We need to do that, don't we? Because Isaiah here is quite comfortable, when he calls them children of prostitutes, he's quite comfortable with this, we could say, marriage kind of romantic metaphor for following the Lord. And we're going to sing a song in a moment, the band are going to lead us. And what I like about this next song is that it does combine those two aspects. It's both romantic love for the Lord, but also majestic worship of his mighty name at the same time. It calls us to love God and to adore him. In this song, he is beautiful and powerful, unfailing love and majestic glory. So as the band lead us, this is a challenge for you. Have you, a bit like the church in Ephesus, have you lost your first love for the Lord? Because if so, let's use this song like as a prayer to say, Lord, rekindle in my heart that covenant love for the Lord, to trust you in your unfailing love. So let's use this song as a kind of a prayer partway through the service, just to respond to God's word. So thanks, guys. Do you want to lead us? And let's all stand. That's great. Thanks, Karen. So back, as Karen has just introduced what we're going to do now, and there's one more PowerPoint. Thanks, Harrison. Is just look at the answer, the antidote. So the first, we get to the comfort bit. This is the good bit now. We've been challenged by the problems. And now what's the answer? What's the antidote to narcissistic leaders and two-timing hearts? Well, here it is. What we need instead are contrite hearts. Now, contrite is an unusual word, isn't it? It's kind of a word we don't use very much anymore. The Hebrew original, it literally means to be crushed, to kind of lie in the dust. But basically, the word means to bow before, to repent before the Lord. In the West, maybe the way you might do before a king in medieval Europe, and in other cultures as well, you bow. In the Far East, it's still common today, you bow before people, and when you bow before them, what you're saying is their status is much higher than yours. And Isaiah is saying that lowliness, that sense you bow and say, no, you're God and I'm not, that's the right response to God. For this is what the high and exalted one says, he who lives forever, whose name is holy, I live in a high and holy place, but also with the one who is contrite and lowly in spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. How are we going to be careful here? Even as I'm speaking, we could be hearing, okay, well, we've got all these problems in the world, and the way we fix them is something we've got to do. I've got to make myself more contrite, more lowly. And if you've ever seen the picture on the screen as well, if you've ever seen the Harrison Ford film Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen the film, Indiana Jones is trying to find the Holy Grail, and at the end he has to pass these three tests to get to the Holy Grail. And the first one is, only a penitent man may pass. And he's thinking about it, and just in time he kneels, so he doesn't have his head cut off by this horrible contraption. Now that is precisely not what it means to be contrite. In fact, it's not something you do at all. Notice in these verses, and this really struck me when I was studying it during the week, notice in all these verses that actually this last part of chapter 57 is all about what God does in us and not what we do at all. And it will be said, build up, prepare the road. Remove the obstacles out of the way of my people. I will not accuse them forever, nor will I always be angry, for then they would just faint away because of me, the very people I've created. I was enraged by their sinful greed. I punished them and hid my face in anger, yet they kept on their willful ways. I have seen their ways, but I will heal them. I will guide them and restore comfort to Israel's mourners. creating praise on their lips. Can you see that? That it's just a sovereign work of God's grace? Yeah, next slide, thanks, Harrison. That you see, we're not Indiana Jones. We're not the ones cleverly working out a path to God. No, contrite people, lowly people, are precisely those who give up, who admit, I cannot work my way to God. This is only going to happen if he works out a way to get to me through the cross. And according to verse 19, that grace and that peace is needed by those who are near as well as those who are far. We don't have time to look in it, but it's language that the Apostle Paul picks up in Ephesians 2, that Jew or Gentile, we all need God's grace. In other words, if you're a sort of a total non-Christian, if you're a pagan on the other side of the world, what you need is to have God's grace and peace preached to you. But equally, if you're a regular churchgoer and you come to RLBC every week, you too need God's grace preached to you. So, if the response today is we've got to be contrite, lowly people, how can you tell if someone is contrite and lowly? Well, it doesn't mean they have to grovel on the ground all the time. But it does mean if they get this stuff about grace, that it's God working towards me, even when I'm pushing against him and my heart is two-timing, then I will have a gentle, non-condemning spirit, won't I? See, the opposite of being contrite is being self-righteous and judgmental. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't speak out against sin or injustice. The chapter ends, you'll see, by the condemning of the wicked. So, of course, we can speak out about what's wrong, but it's the tone, isn't it, that shows whether we're contrite and lowly, doesn't it? When we denounce sin, we do that as a fellow sinner, like someone who's sick telling your friend that's where the doctor is, or one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. It's why Jesus said so much about hypocrisy. Narcissistic leaders, if you think about it, if it's all about the leader, then they have to know the answer to everything because it's all about them. And instead of pointing you to Christ, what they do is point you to themselves. They're the ones who express disappointment that your life is not as holy as their life. Contrite people do that. Lowly people don't do that. Lowly people, of course, they strive for holiness, but they know that the only way we can be right with God is through Christ. So they don't point to themselves, they point to him. Because only he can heal. Only he can grant peace. Peace, the Hebrew word shalom, it means so much more than just silence or absence of war. In fact, peace in the Bible, it's not the absence, it's the presence of God's blessing in your life. It is full contentment. It's life to the full. It's joy. Is that what you want today? Because, as I says, there's no peace for the wicked, or maybe as Jesus put it, instead of, he didn't use the word contrite, but he did say, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Now, it is so countercultural, isn't it? Freud, in the last century, he would tell us that contrite, lowly people, they're repressed, aren't they? They're full of self-loathing, really. Contemporary wisdom will tell us that what we need to be fulfilled and secure and have good self-esteem, you need to be told every day how wonderful you are and how you get nothing wrong and you're perfect. Follow your dreams, we're told. Oh, switch on the telly, how did that work out? No, instead, all the news tells us that there's a mental health epidemic, that depression is rife, and that the more TV programs that tell us how wonderful we are, the sadder we actually become. There is no peace. There is no shalom. And I know it's counterintuitive, but the Bible tells us that it's the contrite, those who are lowly, who really find contentment in life. Now, back in May, researchers from UCL University College London, they launched the Happiness Project, a research app that's going to tell us how we can be happy. Well, the first thing they found out is easy step towards happiness is lower your expectations. Likewise, research has showed us that human beings regularly overestimate how good they are. In fact, they've even got a name for it, the Dunning-Kruger effect. We all think that we are better than we are. Now, you can take that two ways. Apathy is the more common response, just don't know, don't care. It's a kind of a lame way of protecting yourself from getting hurt. But alternatively, Isaiah points us to the true peace, real contentment, that is only found in Jesus Christ. Isaiah 57 is basically the gospel in a nutshell. Be contrite, give up trusting in yourself, and trust in Jesus. Take refuge in Him, and you'll find real peace in this life. Admit that your only hope is in God. Take refuge in the death and resurrection of Jesus, the suffering servant. And that means replacing leaders who are fully themselves with the leader who emptied himself. Let Jesus heal your two-timing heart as you trust in one who literally died to keep his promise to you. Isn't that amazing? So as we finish, I want you to see that the gospel really is the antidote to these problems. Now, I know preachers always say that, and you're scratching your head thinking, well, how does believing Jesus died on the cross for my sins and rose again, you know, how does that sort out things like narcissistic leaders and two-timing hearts? Well, Isaiah points the way. First of all, we've got narcissistic leaders today, haven't we? And it's so easy to criticise men like Donald Trump, to bemoan the state of politicians today. But what Isaiah has challenged, Isaiah today has told us, be careful when we do that. Because the gospel teaches me that I am part of the problem, I'm not part of the solution. That we're all sinners needing Christ's forgiveness. So that means that if I spend all my life, every day, just only telling my children and myself, you know, you're wonderful, you're the best, you can do anything, why am I surprised that then we appoint a US president who says things like, I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created? Yeah, he really did say that in 2015. Now, instead, the gospel teaches me I'm not the greatest, and that's okay. I'm not the Messiah, I'm just a naughty boy who needs the forgiveness of Christ. And therefore a community that really is lowly, is okay, come to the fact that I need God, I am not the greatest on my own. That kind of community, a church like we seek to be, this kind of narcissistic leadership can't grow because there's just no fertilizer, there's no oxygen, there's no water to support that kind of mentality. So again, Alan, when you listen to this later, Isaiah would say, soak yourself in the gospel. If you're worried about making these mistakes, soak yourself in the gospel, because someone who's responded to Christ has to be contrite and lowly. And there's no room for these problems to grow. And it's the same with two-timing hearts, isn't it? Again, surprise, surprise, the answer is the gospel. Of course it really hurts when marriages break up. When people break their promises, it is devastating. But once more, why are we surprised? You know, in our culture, in our society, we keep telling ourselves, you know, follow your dreams, don't let anybody hold you back, do what you want to do. So why are we surprised that people just jump ships the moment something better comes along? But not so with a contrite heart. A lowly spirit is simply grateful for the love that they receive. They're not nursing bitterness about what they think they deserve and what they're missing out on. A lowly spirit, according to Isaiah, is a comforted spirit. A contrite heart, that is the heart that is healed. Peace and contentment is what we need from the one who does know and does care. Remember that verse from earlier on in the passage? For this is what the high and exalted one says, he who lives forever, whose name is holy. I live in a high and holy place, but also with the one who is contrite and lowly in spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly, and to revive the heart of the contrite. That is what it means to have a contrite heart and a lowly spirit. It's not that I spend all my time thinking about how tiny I am and how sinful I am. It's not that I spend every day going, woe is me. But rather, I spend all my day focusing on how great God is and how amazing and holy and wonderful he is. So what are we going to do? A bit like we did earlier, we're now going to finish our service by singing a song if the band want to get ready. Let's reorientate our hearts by singing about God and not about ourselves. Because that, Isaiah says, is how hearts are mended. When we bow at the foot of the cross. When we realise, Lord, it's all about you. It's not about me. It's all about you. And we say, my God, that is who you are. So thanks, guys. Please stand. Let's sing this song to respond.